This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Black and Blue by Anna Quinlan, narrated by Ruth Ann Fimister. This book is copyrighted 1998 by Anna Quinlan. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Fran Benedetto fell in love with Bobby Benedetto when she was 19. But soon their passionate marriage turned into a nightmare. Then one night she finally decided to run, taking her 10-year-old son, living in fear in Florida, trying to start a new life under a new name. And now, Black and Blue.
The first time my husband hit me, I was 19 years old. One sentence and I'm lost. One sentence and I can hear his voice in my head, that butterscotch syrup voice that made goosebumps rise on my arms when I was young, that turned all of my skin warm and alive with a sibilant S, the drawling vowels, its shocking fricatives. It always sounded like a whisper, the way he talked, the intimacy of it, the way the words seemed to go into your guts, your head, your heart.
"Geez, Bob," one of the guys would say, "you should have been a radio announcer. You should have done those voiceover things for commercials."
It was like a genie, wafting purple and smoky from the lamp, Bobby's voice. Or perfume, when you took the glass stopper out of the bottle. I remember going to court once when Bobby was a witness in a case. It was 11, maybe 12 years ago, before Robert was born, before my collarbone was broken, and my nose, which hasn't healed quite right because I said it myself, looking in the bathroom mirror in the middle of the night, petals of adhesive tape fringing the frame. Bobby wanted me to come to court when he was testifying because it was a famous case at the time, although one famous case succeeds another in New York City, the way one pinky gold sunset over the sludge of the Hudson River fades and blooms, brand new each night. A 15-year-old boy from Brooklyn was accused of raping a Dominican nun at knife point and then asking her to pray for him. His attorney said it was a lie, that the kid had had no idea that the woman in the aqua double-knit pants and the striped blouse was a nun, that the sex was consensual, though the nun was 62 and paste-waxing a floor in a shelter at the time. They took paste-wax from the knees of the kid's pants, brought in the paste wax manufacturer to do a chemical comparison. The lawyer was an old guy with a storefront in a bad neighborhood, I remember, and the kid's mother had scraped together the money to hire him because legal aid had sent a black court appointed, and she was convinced that her son needed a white lawyer to win his case. Half blind, hungover, dandruff on the shoulders of his gray suit like a dusting of snow, the kid's attorney was stupid enough to call the kid as a witness and to ask why he had confessed to a crime he hadn't committed.
"There was this cop in the room," the boy said, real low, his broad forehead tipped toward the microphone, his fingers playing idly with his bottom lip so that his words were a little muffled. "He didn't ask none of the questions. He just kept hassling me, man, like he just keep saying, 'Tell us what you did, Tyrone. Tell us what you did.' It was like he hypnotized me, man. He just kept saying it over and over. I couldn't get away from him."
The jury believed that Tyrone Biggs had done the rape, and so did everybody else in New York who read the tabloids, watched the news. So did the judge, who gave him the maximum 8 to 15 years and called him a boil on the body of humanity. But I knew that while Tyrone was lying about the rape, he was telling the truth about that police officer. Because I lived with that voice every day, had been hypnotized by it myself. I knew what it could do, how it could sound. It went down into your soul like a confessor, like a seducer, saying, "Tell me, tell me. Franny, Franny, Fran," he'd croon, whisper, sing. Sometimes Bobby even made me believe that I was guilty of something,
that I was sleeping with every doctor at the hospital, that I made him slip and bang his bad knee, that I made him beat me up, that it was me who made the fist, angled the foot, brought down a hand hard. Hard. The first time he hit me, I was 19. I can hear his voice now, so persuasive, so low, and yet somehow so strong, making me understand once again that I'm all wrong. "Franny, Franny, Fran," he says. That's how he begins. "Franny, Franny, Fran. The first time I wasn't your husband yet. You were already 20 because it was the weekend after we went to City Island for your birthday. And I didn't hit you. You know I didn't hit you. You see, Fran, this is what you do. You twist things. You always twist things." I can hear him in my head. And I know he's right. He didn't hit me that first time. He just held onto my upper arm so tight that the mark of his fingerprints was like a tattoo, a black sun with four small moons revolving around it. It was summer, and I couldn't wear a sundress for a week, or take off my clothes when my sister Grace was in the room we shared, the one that looked out over the air shaft to the Tarnowskis' apartment on the other side. He'd done it because I danced with Dee Stemple's brother and then laughed when he challenged me on it. He held me there, he said, so that I couldn't get away. Because if I got away, it would be the end of him. He loved me that much. The next night, he pushed back the sleeve of my blouse and kissed each mark. And his tears wet the spots as though to wash the black white again, as white as the rest of my white, white skin. As though his tears would do what absolution did for venial sins, wash them clean. "Oh, Jesus," he whispered, "I am so goddamn sorry." And I cried, too. When I cried in those days, it was always for his pain, not for mine. As rich and persuasive as Bobby Benedetto's voice, that was how full and palpable was his sorrow and regret, and how huge was his rage. It was like a twister cloud. It rose suddenly from nothing into a moving thing that blew the roof off, black and strong. I smell beer. I smell bourbon. I smell sweat. I smell my own fear, ranker and stronger than all three. I smell it now in the vast waiting room of 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. There are long wooden benches, and my son Robert and I have huddled together into the corner of one of them. Across from us slumps a man in the moth-eaten motley of the homeless, who smells of beer and vomit like so many I've seen in the waiting room at the hospital, cooking up symptoms from bad feet to blindness to get a bed for the night, an institutional breakfast on a tray. The benches in 30th Street Station are solid, plain, utilitarian, like the pews in St. Stanislaus. The Church of the Holy Polak, Bobby called St. Stanny's, but he still wanted us to be married there, where he'd been baptized, where his father had been eulogized as a cop's cop. I had never lived in one place long enough to have a real home parish, and I'd agreed. Together we'd placed a rose from my bouquet at the side altar, in front of the statue of St. Joseph, in memory of Bobby's father. It was the only memory of his father that Bobby ever shared with me. The great vaulted ceiling of the train station arched four stories over us, Robert and I and our one small carry-all bag. Inside only toothbrushes, a change of clothes, some video game cartridges and a book, a romance novel, stupid, shallow, but I had had enough of real life every day to last me forever. Gilded, majestic, the station was what I'd believed the courtroom would be like that day I went to court, when my husband took the stand. "State your name." "Robert Anthony Benedetto." "And your occupation?" "I'm a police officer for the city of New York." The
courtroom in the state Supreme Court had been nothing at all like 30th Street Station. It was low-ceiling, dingy, paneled in dark wood that sucked up all the light from low windows that looked out on Police Plaza. It seemed more like a rec room than a courtroom. The train station in Philadelphia looked the way I'd always imagined a courtroom would look. Or maybe the way one would look in a dream, if you were dreaming you were the judge, or the accused. Robert was staring up at the ceiling, so high above that those of us scattered around the floor so far below were diminished, almost negated by it. At one end of the huge vaulted room was a black statue of an angel, holding a dead or dying man. I thought it was a war memorial, and under normal circumstances I would have walked across to read the inscription on the block beneath the angel's naked toes. But whatever the opposite of normal circumstances was, this was it. I shivered in the air conditioning, dressed for July in a room whose temperature was lowered to April, my mind as cold as January. The statue was taller than our little house down the block from the bay in Brooklyn, taller than my in-law's house, or the last building where I'd lived with my parents, the one in Bensonhurst, where in the crowded little bedroom I'd dressed in my wedding gown, snagging the hem of my train on a popped nail in the scuffed floorboards. The sheer heroic thrust of the station made me feel tiny, almost invisible, almost safe, except that my eyes wandered constantly from the double glass doors to the street at one end to the double glass doors to the street at the other, waiting, watching, waiting for Bobby to come through the doors, his hands clenched in his pants pockets, his face the dusky color that flooded it whenever he was angry about anything, which was lots of the time. I'd been waiting for Bobby to come through doors most of my life, waiting and watching to gauge his mood, and so my own. A finger of sweat traced my spine and slid into the cleft where my underpants began. The cotton at my crotch was wet, summer sweat and fear. I'd been afraid so many times that I thought I knew exactly what it felt like, but this was something different altogether, like the difference between water and ice. Ice in my belly, in my chest, beneath my breast, between my eyes, as though I'd gulped down a lemonade too quickly in the heat. Brain freeze, Robert and his friends called it when it happened to them, and they'd reel around the kitchen holding their heads. Wait on the bench by the coffee kiosk, the man had said. He had driven us from New York to Philadelphia in total silence like a well-trained chauffeur. As we got out of the old Plymouth Volare in front of the train station, he had leaned across the front seat, looking up at me through the open passenger door. He had smelled like English leather, which Bobby had worn when we were both young, before we were married. Bobby had worn it that time when I was 19. The first time. Or 20. I guess it was right, Bobby's voice in my head. I guess I'd just turned 20 that first time. Maybe he was testing me then, to see how much I could take. Maybe he did that every time, until finally he had decided that I would take anything. Anything at all. What? Robert had said, looking up at me as the man in the Volare drove away to wherever he came from, whoever he was. What did he say? Where are we going now? Where are we going? And there was the coffee kiosk, and here was the bench, and here we were, my 10-year-old son and I, waiting for... what? Waiting to escape. To get gone. To disappear so that Bobby could never find us. I think Robert knew everything when he saw me that morning, cutting my hair in the medicine cabinet mirror, whispering on the phone, taking off the bandages and throwing them in the trash, putting all the recent photographs in an envelope and addressing it to my sister, Grace, so that Bobby wouldn't have good pictures to show people when he started to search for us. Where are we going? Robert had asked. On a trip, I'd replied. If Robert had been an ordinary 10-year-old, he would have cajoled and whined, asked and asked and asked until I snapped at him to keep quiet. But he'd never been ordinary. For as long as either of us could remember, he'd been a boy with a secret, and he'd kept it well. He had to have heard the sound of the slaps, the thump of the punches, the bird call of my sobs as I taped myself up, swabbed myself off, put my pieces back together again. He'd seen my bruises after the fact. He'd heard the sharp intakes of breath when he hugged too hard in places I was hurt. But he looked away, the way he knew we both wanted him to. My husband for his reasons, me for mine. It was just that last time, when he came in from school and I turned at the kitchen counter, his apple slices on a plate, his milk in a glass. My face swollen, misshapen, the colors of a spectacular sunset just before nightfall, my smile a clownish wiggle of a thing because of my split lip. That he couldn't manage to look away, disappear upstairs, pretend he didn't see. "Mom, oh, Mom," he'd said, his eyes enormous. "Don't worry," I'd replied before he could say more. "I'll take care of everything." "Mom," he'd said again. And then maybe he remembered. Remembered the secret. Remembered all those mornings after the horrible sounds and screams. How his father would sit at the table drinking coffee from his PBA mug. How I'd come in from running and go up to shower, how everyone acted as though everything was just as it should be. So the wild light in his eyes flared, flickered, died. And he added, "Was it an accident?" Because that's what I'd said, year after year. An accident. I had an accident. The accident was that I met Bobby Benedetto in a bar, and I fell crazy in love with him. And after that, I fell further and further every year. Not so you'd notice if you knew me, although no one really did. On the outside, I looked fine. The job, the house, the kid, the husband, the smile. Nobody got to see the hitting, which was really the humiliation, which turned into the hatred. Not just hating Bobby, but hating myself, too. The cringing self that was afraid to pick up the remote control from the coffee table in case it was just that thing that set him off. I remember a story in the Daily News a couple of years ago about a guy who kept a woman chained in the basement of the building where he was a custodian. Whenever he felt like it, he went down the concrete steps and did what he wanted to her. Part of me had been in a cellar, too, waiting for the sound of footfalls on the stairs. And I wasn't even chained. I stayed because I thought things would get better, or at least not worse. I stayed because I wanted my son to have a father and I wanted a home. For a long time, I stayed because I loved Bobby Benedetto, because no one had ever gotten to me the way he did. I think he knew that. He made me his accomplice in what he did, and I made Robert mine. Until that last time, when I knew I had to go. When I knew that if I told my son I'd broken my nose, blacked my eyes, split my lip by walking into the dining room door in the dark, that I would have gone past some point of no return. The secret was killing the kid in him and the woman in me, what was left of her. I had to save him and myself. "Where are we going, Mom?" he whined in the station. But he did it like any kid would on any long trip, and it almost made me laugh and smile and cry, too, to hear him sound so ordinary instead of so dead and closed up. Besides, he knew. He knew we were running away from his father, as far and as fast as we could. I wanted to say, "Robert, baby, hun, I'm taking you out of the cellar. I'm taking you to where there won't be secrets anymore."
but that wasn't exactly true. There'd just be different secrets now.
There are people who will do almost anything in America, who will paint your house, paint your toenails, choose your clothes, mind your kids. In Manhattan, at the best private schools, you can even hire a nitpicker if your kid gets head lice. And there are people who will help you get away from your husband, who will find you a new house, a new job, a new life, even a new name. They are mysterious about it because they say it's what they need to do to keep you safe. When she goes on television, their leader, a woman named Patty Bancroft, likes to say, "We do not even have a name for ourselves." Maybe that's why I'd felt I had to whisper when I talked to her on the phone, even though Bobby was long gone from the house, to keep their secret, my secret. "There are people," Patty Bancroft had said, "who will help you. It's better if you know no more than that." I looked down at Robert, hunched over on the bench, bent almost double over a little electronic game he carried with him everywhere. Ninjas in glowing green lunged forward and kicked men in black masks. The black masks fell back, fell over like felled trees. The ninjas bowed. The number at one corner of the screen grew larger. Robert was breathing as though he had been running. I ran my hand over his dark hair, cut like a long tonsure over his narrow pointed skull. My touch was an annoyance. He leaned slightly to one side and rocked forward to meet the ninjas, take them on, knock them down. He was good at these games, at losing himself in the tinny electronic sounds and glowing pictures. My sister Grace said all the kids were these days. But I wondered. I looked across the station at a small girl in overalls who was toddling from stranger to stranger, smiling and waving while her mother followed 6 paces behind. Even when he was small, Robert had never, ever been like that. Grace said kids were born with personalities, and Robert's was as dignified an adult as his name. But I wondered. When Robert was 3, he sometimes sat and stared and rocked slightly back and forth, and I worried that he was autistic. He wasn't, of course. The doctor said so.
"Jesus, talk about making a mountain out of a whatever," Bobby had said,
reaching to lift the child and never even noticing the way in which the small bony shoulders flinched like the wings of a bird preparing to fly, to flee.
"We're going on a trip," I'd told Robert that morning.
"Where?"
he'd said.
"It's kind of a surprise."
"Is Daddy coming?"
"Not if we're lucky," a voice in my head had said, but out loud I'd replied, "He has to work." Robert's face had gone dead, the way it does sometimes, particularly the morning after a bad night, a night when Bobby and I have gotten loud.
"Is that why you're wearing glasses?" he said.
"Sort of, yeah. They look funny." In the station, he looked up from his video game and stared at me as though he was trying to figure out who I was, with the strange hair, the glasses, the long floaty dress. The ninjas were all dead. He had won. His eyes were bright.
"Tell me where we're going," he said again.
"I will," I said, as though I knew. "In a little while."
"Can I get gum?"
"Not now." Around the perimeter of the station were small shops and kiosks, cheap jewelry, fast food, newspapers, books, the money changers in the temple. The voice of the train announcer was vaguely English. There was a stately air to the Enterprise, unlike the shabby, overlit corridors of the airports. "No planes," Patty Bancroft told me when we first talked on the phone 2 weeks before. "Plane trips are too easy to trace." The women she helped never flew away. They were not birds, but crawling creatures, supplicants, beaten down, trains, buses, cars, and secrecy. When I'd first met Patty Bancroft, when she'd come to the hospital where I worked, She'd said that she had hundreds of volunteers all over the country. She said her people knew one another only as voices over the telephone, and had in common only that for reasons of their own, they had wanted to help women escape the men who hurt them, to give those women new lives in new places, to help them lose themselves, start over in the great, expansive, anonymous sameness of America.
"What about men who are beaten by their wives?" one of the young doctors at the hospital had asked that day.
"Don't make me laugh," Patty Bancroft had said wearily, dismissively.
She'd given me her card that day, in case I ever treated a woman in the emergency room who needed more than sutures and ice packs, needed to escape, to disappear, to save her life by getting gone for good.
"Nurses are one of my greatest sources of referral," she had said, clasping my hand, looking seriously into my eyes. It was the most chaste business card I'd ever seen. Her name and a telephone number. No title, no address. Just a handful of lonely black characters. I put the card in my locker at the hospital. I must have picked it up 100 times until, 6 months later, I called the number. She remembered me right away. "Tell me about this patient," Patty Bancroft had said. "It's me," I said, and my voice had faltered, fell into a hiss, a whisper of shame. "It's me." "Where are we going?" I had asked her when we spoke on the phone 2 days before the man in the Volare had picked us up at a subway stop in Upper Manhattan, 2 weeks after Bobby had beaten me for the last time. My voice was strange and stiff. My nose and jaw had begun to heal, so that if I didn't move my mouth too much, the pain was no more than a soft throb at the center of my face.
"You'll know when you get there," Patty Bancroft said.
"I'm not going away without knowing where I'm going," I said.
"Then you'll have to stay where you are," she'd replied. "This is the way it works." My hand had crept to my nose, pressed on the bridge as though testing my resolve. I felt the pain in my molars, the back of my head, the length of my spine. I felt the blood still seeping from between my legs, like a memory of something I'd already made myself forget. "The bleeding will stop in a week or so," they'd said at the clinic. "Pack plenty of clean underpants," I thought to myself. "That's what it comes down to, finally, no matter how terrifying your life has become. A toothbrush, batteries, clean underpants. The small things keep you from thinking about the big ones. Concealer stick. Tylenol." My face had faded to a faint yellow-green in the time it had taken me to plan my getaway. Bobby had been working a lot of nights. We'd scarcely seen one another. "What will happen if you leave and then your husband finds you?" Patty Bancroft had said. "He'll kill me," I answered. "He won't find you if you do what we say." And she'd hung up the phone. The station public address system bleated and blared.
"Mom, can I have a Coke?" Robert said, in that idle way in which children make requests, as though it's expected of them. The video game in his hands lay in his lap, and he'd tilted his head back to look up at the ceiling.
"Not now," I said.
A line of people in business suits had formed at the head of one of the stairways leading to the tracks. Two of them talked on cellular phones. A woman with a handsome leather suitcase on a wheeled stand left the line and walked toward the coffee kiosk. Her heels made a percussive noise on the stone floor.
"Café au lait, please," the woman said to the girl behind the counter. She looked at her watch, then turned and smiled at me, looked down at the floor, looked up again.
"You dropped your tickets," she said.
She handed me an envelope she stooped to pick up from the floor.
"Oh, no, I..."
"You dropped your tickets," she said again, smiling, her voice firm. and I could feel the corner of the envelope, a sharp point against my wet palm.
"Metroliner," called a uniformed man at the head of the stairs, and the woman picked up her coffee and wheeled her suitcase to the stairway without looking back.
I sat down heavily on the bench and opened the envelope.
"God," groaned Robert, hunched over his game.
"What?"
"Nothing," he said.
Inside the envelope were two tickets to Baltimore on the 4 p.m. Metroliner. I looked at the big digital clock and the wall timetable. 3:12. And the next Metroliner was on time. There were other things in the envelope, too. Bus tickets, a driver's license, social security cards. For a moment I was blind with confusion, and then I found the names. Crenshaw, Elizabeth. Crenshaw, Robert. I had not liked it when Patty Bancroft gave me orders on the phone, but now I felt a powerful sense of gratitude. She had let me have my way in at least one thing. Robert had gotten to keep his own first name. And I was to be Elizabeth. Liz, Beth, Libby. Elizabeth Crenshaw. Seeing myself reflected in the glass of the coffee kiosk, I could almost believe it. There she was, Elizabeth Crenshaw. She had short blonde hair, a pixie crop that I'd created with kitchen scissors and hair dye in the bathroom just before sunup, just after I heard the door shut behind Bobby as he left for work. She wore a pair of gold-rimmed glasses bought from a rack at the pharmacy, clear glass with the kind of cheap sheen to the lenses that turned the eyes behind them into twin slicks of impenetrable glare. Elizabeth Crenshaw was thin, all long bones and taut muscles, because Fran Benedetto had been running for more than a decade, and because terror had made it hard for her, these last few years, to eat without feeling the food rise back up into her gorge at a word, a sound, a look.
"Skin and bones," Bobby said sometimes when I was naked, reaching for me.
It had taken me a while that morning to decide what to wear, but I was accustomed to being concerned with my own clothes, even though I didn't care about them much. Not like Bobby's mother, who was forever seeking discount silk and cashmere, trousers cut perfectly to her tiny frame, jackets and skirts with good linings and labels. Much of the time I wore my nurse's uniform, the white washing out my thin freckled skin and making a garish orange of my hair. But let me change into anything snug or short or low, and I would see Bobby's eyes go narrow and bright. Although it was always hard to tell exactly what would offend until the moment when he put his head to one side and looked me up and down until my pale skin flushed.
"Jesus Christ," he'd say in that voice. "You wearing that?"
And I would feel like a whore. Me, plain Franny Benedetto, who had been up half the night with her little boy who had a stomach bug, who had been on her feet all day carrying syringes and gauze pads and clipboards and pills, calming down the drunks and hysterics, stopping to talk to the children, placating the doctors. Fran Benedetto, who had never been with a man other than her husband, but let her wear a blouse whose fabric suggested the faintest hint of slip-strap, and all of a sudden she was a slut. Slip-strap over bra-strap, of course, for if I wore a skirt and didn't wear a full slip, the way Bobby's mother always had, there was no telling what Bobby might do. It was funny, after a while. I could tell you what Bobby liked and didn't like, what might set him off and how much. But I couldn't have told you as much about myself. I was mostly reaction to Bobby's actions, at least by the end. My clothes, my makeup, they were more or less his choice. I bought them, of course, but bought them with one eye always on Bobby's face and his hands. But Beth Crenshaw I would create myself, without reference to Bobby. I started to create her even before I found out her name in the waiting room at 30th Street Station. Beth Crenshaw wore a loose, long-flowered dress I'd found in the back of my closet from two summers before, the sort of dress that Bobby always said made women look like grandmothers. Bobby's own grandmother, his father's mother, always wore black, even to picnics and street fairs. "Come here, Fran," she'd yell across her daughter-in-law's white-on-white living room, where she sat like a big blot of ink on the couch. She'd fold herself around me and cover me in black, make me feel small and safe. "Aw, God bless you, you're too thin," she'd say. "She's too thin, Bob, you need to make her eat." She died just before Robert was born, Bobby's Nana. I missed her. Maybe it would have happened anyhow, but I think Bobby got harder after that. Harsher, too. "The reason you hooked up with me," I said to Bobby once when we were young, "is because my red hair and white skin look good next to your black hair and your tan."
"That was part of it," he said.
That was a good day that day. We played miniature golf at a course owned by a retired narcotics guy in Westchester. Had dinner at that Italian place in Pelham, made out in the car at a rest stop on the Sawmill River Parkway. Both of us living with our parents, he in the police academy, me in nursing school, we had no place else to go. The first time we had sex, it was in a cabana at that skanky beach club his mother liked. A friend of his from high school who vacuumed the pool let us stay after closing. It didn't hurt. I didn't bleed. I loved it. I loved how helpless it made him. Big, bad, tanned, muscled Bobby Benedetto, his mouth open, the whites of his eyes showing. It made me want to sit on his lap the rest of my life. He talked about getting a tattoo on his shoulder, a rose, and the word Francis. I said I'd get Yosemite Sam on my upper thigh. "The hell you will," he said. It turned out I didn't need it. Bobby tattooed me himself with his hands. "Red hair is too conspicuous," Patty Bancroft had said on the phone. It had been the only conspicuous thing about me all these years. Smart, but not too. Enterprising, but not too. Friendly, but not too. The kind of girl who becomes a nurse, not a doctor. The kind of nurse who becomes assistant head, but not head nurse. The kind of wife... Well, no one knew about that. "There's still some good years left on her," Bobby would say when his friends came over, and they'd laugh. It was the way they all talked about their wives, and I wondered, looking at their flushed and friendly faces, if they were thinking of bones that had not yet been broken, areas that had not yet blossomed with bruises. And they looked at me and saw a happy wife and mother like so many others, a working woman like so many others. Fran Flynn, you know, the skinny redhead who works in the ER at South Bay. Franny Benedetto, the cop's wife on Beach 12th Street, the one with the little boy with the bow legs. Gone down the drain that morning. Transformed, perhaps forever, by loving care number 27 California Blonde. Hidden behind the glasses, disguised by the flapping folds of the long dress. California Blonde Elizabeth Crenshaw, with nothing but thin, milky skin and faint constellations of freckles on chest and cheeks, to connect her to Frances Ann Flynn Benedetto. A bruise on my right cheek, faded to yellow, and a bump on the bridge of my nose. And Robert, of course. The only thing I'd had worth taking with me from that tidy house, where Bobby liked to walk on the carpeting barefoot, and I cleaned up the blood with club soda and Clorox before the stain set. Beth. I liked Beth. I was leaving. I was starting over again. I was saving my life. I was sick of the fear and the fists. And I was keeping my son safe, too. Not because his father had ever hit him, he never ever had. But because the secret inside our house, the secret about what happened at night, when Daddy was drunk and disgusted with himself and everything around him, was eating the life out of Robert. When he was little, he would touch a bruise softly, saying, "Your boo-boo, Mama?" When he got a little older, he sometimes said, narrowing his big black eyes, Mommy, how did you hurt yourself? But now he only looked, as though he knew to be quiet, as though he thought this was the way life was. My little boy, who had always had something of the little old man about him, was becoming a dead man, too, with a dead man's eyes. There are ways and ways of dying, and some of them leave you walking around. I'd learned that from watching my father, and my husband, too. I wasn't going to let it happen to my son. Francis couldn't. Beth wouldn't. That's who I was now. Francis Ann Flynn Benedetto was always watching and waiting, scared of her husband, scared he would turn on her, hit her, finally knock her out for good. Scared to leave her son with no mother to raise him, only a father whose idea of love was bringing you soup after he'd broken your collarbone. Franny Flynn was gone. I'd killed her myself. I was Beth Crenshaw now. Beneath the rippling skirt, I could feel my legs trembling as an announcer with a sonorous voice called out the trains. But I could feel my legs, too, feel them free. No slip. I'd left that goddamn slip behind. Franny Flynn. That's how I'd thought of myself again, even though my last name was legally Benedetto. The name on my checks, on my license, on the embossed plastic name tag I wore on the breast of my nurse's uniform, Francis F. Benedetto. But in my mind, I'd gone back to being Franny Flynn. Maybe Bobby knew that. Maybe he could read my mind. Maybe that was part of the problem, that he could read my mind, and I never had a clue what was going on in his. Franny, Franny, Fran. I heard his voice saying my name, like the ringing in my ears when he brought his open hand hard against the side of my head in a dark corner of the club foyer. That time I argued with him in front of his friends about whether we were staying for another round of beers at a retirement party. Fran. I can hear his voice in the sound of the train moving south down the tracks. I'm coming, Franny. You can't get away. You're mine, Fran. Both of you. I still can't figure out why everyone in New York talks about Florida as if it's a cross between Paris and Lourdes. The pilgrimages to Disney World, the fabled retirement condos in Lauderdale. Moira Doherty, now she's got a life, one of the cop wives said at a barbecue. Kevin put in his time, and now there they are, not even 50 yet, in Boca, both of them working part-time. She gave me her rabbit jacket. I won't be needing it, hun, she said. Nice and warm down here, even in January. What a racket. Maybe Moira's lying on a lounge chair, watching the sun on the water. But Robert and I wound up in a garden apartment court in a dusty town called Lake Plata, almost an hour's drive to the ocean. Or that's what I'm told. I don't have a car, so I wouldn't know. There's an irony for you. I went from Brooklyn to Florida and wound up trading down, exchanging a house with the Atlantic at the end of the block, shimmering between two rows of attached imitation brick fronts like a mirage, for a square of gravel studded with gnarled bushes, no water in sight except for the pools that sit outside the motels on the highway. There's a flatness to Florida, or at least this part of it. It makes me feel like I'm in one of those rooms in a horror film where the ceiling lowers and lowers and the floor rises, trapping you, squishing you flat. Although, come to think of it, that's the way I'd felt in my own living room for a long time. Whenever I heard the sound of Bobby's Trans Am pulling into the garage beneath the couch and the carpeted floor. When we got to Florida, and Robert and I stepped inside the apartment Patty Bancroft's people had arranged for us, I'd realized it reminded me of the apartments I'd lived in when I was a kid. I could almost smell the bland steam that was the smell of cooking in my parents' house. I could almost hear the soft whoosh of my father sucking oxygen hungrily through the heavy black rubber mask. and I could almost see the notes my mother left for me next to the stove. In her angular handwriting and then in Greg's shorthand. Once she'd made me take the secretarial course at Queen of Peace. Whitewash, ham butt, drugstore. Franny's to-do list. My mother had needed to work for as long as I could remember, and so, as a result, had I. Robert had known the worst as soon as we stepped inside the place. As soon as he looked around at the dim L-shaped living room with a wood grain dinette in the short arm of the L, seen the nubby tweed couch, the kind that's supposed to be stain resistant but couldn't possibly look any worse with a stain or two. He tried to pull up the blinds until I told him sharply to get away from the window. "Are we going to Disney World?" he'd asked, back when we were taking the IRT from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and then again as we drove from Manhattan South to Philadelphia in the old Volare, its driver wordless behind the wheel. Now he knew the answer. On the train from Philadelphia to Baltimore, he'd fallen asleep open-mouthed, his face mirrored in the window, and he'd slept on the bus we took from Baltimore to Atlanta. The bus tickets had been tucked into the envelope behind the Metroliner tickets.
"Mom, where are we?"
Robert had said when we got off the bus in Atlanta, his eyes dim with sleep and fatigue. "You must be the Crenshaws," said a short woman whose car was parked at the curb, a minivan full of children's car seats. "Yes," I said, and Robert had looked at me as if I'd lost my mind.
"Where are we going?"
he'd said again, more insistently. The woman ignored him, glided over his words with her own as though she was used to doing it. "I've got a nice snack for you in the back," she said cheerily. She was kind, that woman, although she talked for 3 hours straight about her show dogs, corgis, just like the ones the Queen of England had. She was nervous, but she'd brought some juice, some crackers, and an apple for Robert, and a blessed thermos of coffee for me. Robert got car sick twice, throwing up on the shoulder of the highway while I rubbed the sweet spot between his shoulder blades, and the dog breeder called, "Hurry up, hurry up!" "How did you get into this work?" I'd asked, after Robert had fallen asleep again, after the woman had finished feeding me the false biography to go with my new name, finished filling me in on the made-up life in Wilmington, Delaware, and Robert Crenshaw Sr., the estranged husband who was an accountant. "How do you know Mrs. Bancroft?" She'd turned on the radio. "Didn't they tell you not to talk about any of that?" she said. "They didn't tell me much of anything." "That's for the best," the woman said. "There's a box of donuts in the back. Here's your house key." I don't know what I'd expected when I opened the door of number 7 Poinsettia Way, its aluminum painted dark brown, its peephole glowing like a glass eye. I was just glad to stand still, to stop moving, to stop running.
"Where are we, Mom?"
Robert had said for what seemed like the 100th time, and what could I say to him?
"We're home."
His home was on the bay in Brooklyn, his room carpeted in a blue so thick and vivid that it was like walking through the sky, his shelves and drawers filled with everything he'd ever wanted. Stuffed bears, battery-powered robots, plastic supermen, electronic games. So that he could sit in his room for hours and not go out where things were scary. Out on the streets, his father said. Out in the kitchen, I thought, where there were loud voices and sharp noises and sometimes crying, too. Numbers were singing in my head. 153-49-5151. That was Elizabeth M. Crenshaw's social security number. $1,256. That was how much had been in our joint checking account, and half of it was in a wad at the bottom of my purse. And Gracie's phone number. If only I could talk to my sister, The way I had in the half-light of our bedroom when we were girls, the street lamps shining in a divot of yellow across our twin beds. The car wheels a hiss outside on the city streets. I'd never hidden anything from Gracie, at least until after I was married. She was 6 years younger than I was. My baby as much as my mother's, probably more. Me pushing her around the neighborhood in my old stroller when she was a toddler. Telling her the names of things, singing Old MacDonald. Always interrupted by people making comments about her burning bush of curly hair. Like mine, but brighter, wilder. If only I could talk to Grace the way I did when we were older. Lying in the darkness, listening to her questions, answering them as best I could. How come the nuns can't get married? How old were you when you got your period? How many feet in a yard, yards in a mile? What's our address now? 8 apartments I'd lived in with my parents before I'd married Bobby when I was 21. In 6 of them, I'd shared a room with Gracie. There was never any discernible reason for why we moved. We never moved up or even down, just from one shabby 2-bedroom in Brooklyn to another. As suddenly as the weather changing, we'd get dressed one Saturday, the first week of the month, and load the couch and the easy chair and my father's oxygen into a U-Haul, and lie down to sleep that night a dozen blocks away. "What's the point of hanging pictures?" my mother always said, the sound of my father's wheezing a counterpoint from in front of the television. The mirror was always sitting atop her bureau, propped against the wall. They'd given me low expectations, all those places. All I wanted was a house that felt like home, where the furniture matched, where the carpet was clean and a color I liked. I wanted to sit in a big chair in a den somewhere with my feet up on an ottoman and look around and think, this is my home. I wanted to be able to picture myself in that same room 30 years in the future, with my kids grown and my grandchildren babies, and the smell of my cooking so familiar that no one even noticed it anymore. It didn't seem like too much to ask. And there was a while there, with Bobby, when I thought I had it nailed. I'd had a neighbor who kept the key to my house in case I locked myself out, a butcher who knew that I wanted a loin of pork with the bone out, a school at the end of the street, a climbing rose working its way up the supports of the deck out back. I'd had roots. I knew how deep they'd gone. Knew it so powerfully when we stepped into that fugitive apartment, my boy and I. My eyes burning as we stood on the threshold. It was not an anonymous apartment, this narrow duplex somewhere in central Florida, miles and miles from the coast. That would have been bad enough. It was, like those others where I'd spent the years before I married Bobby, redolent of the lives of dozens upon dozens of strangers who'd smoked cigarettes, fried chicken, taken showers, slept late, risen early. It was a transient place, right down to the ubiquitous sound of the tap dripping into the scarred stainless steel sink. When I entered that apartment, I hated Bobby Benedetto with a ferocity I had never allowed myself to feel while I was living with him. I hated him on behalf of my lost life, on behalf of my bedspread and dust ruffle, my landscape over the couch and my guest towels in the powder room. Forced back into the rootless life I thought I'd left behind when I married him, I hated him so that, in that moment, I thought if we ever met again, I'd be just as likely to murder him as he me. But after 2 weeks, the feeling dulled, and I kept thinking I should count my blessings. Isn't that what Daddy always said, coughing in his recliner, when I complained about not being able to go away to college or take a job at the beach with my girlfriends in the summer because then Grace would have no one to look out for her? Count your blessings. My nose no longer hurts. The bleeding has stopped. And 4 doors down in the horseshoe of our little apartment court is a family named Castro, and among their 5 children is a 10-year-old boy who has mastered the 6th level of Double Dragon, whatever that is. You know the finishing move? Benny Castro asked Robert the 3rd horribly bright morning we had been there.
The games kept them grounded, so that Robert was either upstairs or on the front steps, he and Benny shoulder to shoulder bent together over the flickering screen. Benny has 2 sisters, 12 and 4, and brothers who are 7 and 5, and it's a great luxury for him to be almost alone, with no siblings demanding his attention or his toys. So every day now he comes to our apartment, and he and Robert sit upstairs, the ninjas punching one another incessantly. Mrs. Castro just smiles and nods and says in pidgin English that this is very nice of me, and acts as though there is nothing noteworthy about the fading bruises on my face. With her round cheeks, her hair scraped back into a ponytail, her Tasmanian devil t-shirt and dimpled knees, she seems younger than any of her children. "Good boy," she says, nodding at my son. Occasionally, the 2 boys go outside to ricochet around the quadrangle of stunted grass and cement, and I stand guard and watch their every move, flushed and sweating in the Florida heat. Sandy, the youngest Castro, shadows them as Gracie once did me, running back and forth on the ragged pavement that makes a broad U around the perimeter of the garden apartment complex. Occasionally, she stumbles and falls on a piece of concrete heaved up by a tree root, sees narrow red pinstripes begin to form on the yellow-brown skin of her knee. She wails, shrieks, forces enormous tears from beneath her spiky lashes, calls for Mama as though she is drowning and her mother is on the boat. A moment later, there is the thin sound of chimes in the muggy air. "Ice cream!" the little girl shrieks, tears still glittering on her cheeks as she dances and claps. The definition of redemption. My son scarcely ever cries, and his smile comes so seldom that it's like bright sunshine on winter snow, blinding and strange. It's been this way for as long as I can remember. "Robert's an old soul," Grace used to say, maybe because she knew I needed to hear it, to think Robert's silence, his preternatural self-possession, were inherent, not acquired, not the equivalent of covering your ears, hiding your eyes. But when Benny's little sister hugs Robert's legs, he always smiles down at her. I had a kid in a coma once, when I was working med-surg instead of ER, and I remember the look on the face of his mother when he blinked his eyes and muttered "water" after he'd been close to dead for a month. That must be the look I have as I watch Robert smile down upon the shiny ebony head of Sandy Castro. The look of a woman whose child has come back to life. "This isn't a vacation," Robert had said in a low, shaky voice when we'd first entered the apartment. And he must have seen the look on my face, because he went up the narrow stairs and didn't come down again. I lay on the couch, exhausted, the cheap fabric scratchy against my face, and all at once I was asleep, asleep as deep as unconsciousness. When I woke, most of the day had gone. The place was as quiet as if it was still empty, and I took the stairs 2 at a time to the bedrooms, calling Robert's name, and found him asleep yet again. I stood over him and looked down at his splayed legs, the hands let loose from their habitual half-fists, the big bottom lip like his father's, the light coffee skin. I'd breastfed him for almost a year, an excuse to hold his warm body close. "Who'd have thought, and you as small as you are," my mother-in-law had said, eyeing the exposed breast disapprovingly. On the beach on summer Sundays, I'd taken my time rubbing on his sunscreen, feeling the stalk of his spine beneath my fingers, vertebra after vertebra, loved by me. At night in his room, I'd read him 1 fish, 2 fish, as he curled into the semicircle of my welcoming torso. "Your baby, that kid," Bobby said, sometimes with a sweet smile and a hand on my arm.
sometimes with a sneer, a snort.
"Hey, big guy,"
Bobby always said to Robert. And he'd cuff the boy lightly, playfully, as though to prove that Robert had nothing to fear from his father's fists. Once one of the cop wives asked me why Bobby didn't wear a wedding ring. Asked me in a way that suggested that maybe my husband spent time in the bars and clubs of Manhattan passing himself off as a single guy. And maybe he did. But the reason he'd stopped wearing his ring was because it had once split the skin when he punched me in the shoulder. I guess you could consider it, that he didn't want that to happen again. But of course it implied that there would be an again. And there always was. The second day after we'd arrived in Florida, when Robert still hadn't spoken, I sat on the edge of his bed as evening deepened into night and talked to his back as I rubbed it. "We're going to stay here for a while, maybe for a long time." He was curled up on his side, his hands with their long fingers pressed together between his knees. "This isn't a vacation," he said again, but this time with the dull flatness of fact. "We're kind of hiding, Ba," I said. "No one knows we're here. No one here knows who we are." "Who from?" he said, even though I knew he knew. "Why?"
"What?
Who are we hiding from? Why are we hiding?" I took a breath and looked at my nails. They'd grown long, too long for a nurse's nails. But I hadn't been able to go to work in almost 2 weeks, not with my face every color, blue and yellow and green, like the faces we'd worked on in the emergency room, shrugging our shoulders and scrawling comments on the chart. Pas D.A., possible domestic abuse. It had always come over me, a weakness in my legs, when I wrote that on some other woman's records. I should know. "From Daddy. We're hiding from Daddy. You know that. You know he hurt me. You saw my face. I know that's hard for you, but Daddy hit me, Ba. He really hurt me. More than once, a lot more than once. You know that. You saw me. You saw what I looked like lots of times. This last time was bad. Really, really bad." And suddenly he was up and at me. His black eyes were big and his face flushed, and I reared back and then tried to reach for him as I saw the ghostly curlicues where tears had dried on his cheeks. "No, he didn't. You said he didn't. I heard you tell the people at work that you fell. And Aunt Grace, and Grandmom, you said you fell down or got sick, stuff like that. I heard you on the phone." "Ba," I said, his baby name. Baba Black Sheep, shortened to Baba, and then to a single syllable, explosive with love. I reached out my hand, but he pulled back, curled up and turned away. His raised shoulder like a fin, a blade, a wall. How many times had he lain in bed at night just like this and heard the sound of hand against flesh, shoulder against wall, the sound of the arguments about dinner, disrespect, adultery, a trip to Dorney Park, washer fluid for the car, no garbage bags, no rye bread, the wrong kind of mustard.